Market Music with Fairbairn and Russell.
Welcome to the Market Musings podcast, where today we welcome Scott Kynes, the CEO of Corsyl PLC. Hello, Scott. Welcome.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Hi, Kenny.
Yep. Hi, Mark. Hi, Scott.
Hi.
We're all phoning from today because everybody's moved about a bit. So we have, especially you, Mark.
Yeah, so I've moved to The Hague in the Netherlands. Is this the first Market Musings podcast from the new location, is it? I think it might be.
Yeah, it could possibly be.
Well, we did one, didn't we? We did Bernard, didn't we? He was a Market Musings.
Codal Minerals.
We've done one, yeah. So this is the second one, yeah. And you're obviously still in Scotland. What's the weather like? Yep. We should do a weather report, don't we?
It's still wet and miserable. I was just saying Scott's been like it the whole weekend.
Oh, dear.
Not cold, but it's a bit damp and dreich, as they say up here.
I've been to the beach today. It was a beautiful day over here. So not
yeah, just, it's gorgeous down here as
not
well.
Not rubbing it in London.
In London, it's nice.
26 today or something like that with not a cloud in the sky, so can't complain.
Well, we're on
Indian summer going on, I think.
Yeah, The Hague is on a similar sort of meridian, is that right? I don't know, or a similar line as sort of London. So I'm used to being up in York, so I'm used to having sort of slightly more northern weather. So it's probably a little bit warmer where I am now. I'm more in line with where you are, Scott. So yeah, it's been a lovely day over here. Anyway, it's good to have you on, Scott. I know I've known you for a long time, back in the sort of Regency Mines days. Well, it's Indeed. Still Regency, isn't it? It's a new brand.
Technically the same legal entity, but obviously, you know, part of what we could talk about today is how we think that it is, it truly is a new entity, even if it has the same technical legal identifier.
Yeah.
Well, so, before we get into that then, Scott, we'd like to sort of, we do it with every director or CEO we get on, and we like to dig into their past, and you've certainly got quite an interesting past, so sure. It's up to you how far you want to go back. You can go back to, obviously, where you were born, what your education was like, and then there's a military aspect in there as well.
Correct, so a little bit different than the typical, AMCO, I suppose. But yeah, I'm from St. Louis, so St. Louis, Missouri, which is right in the middle of the country. This is the Midwestern U.S. A lot of people think it's the South, but I would say it's more it's on that border, I suppose. And obviously, it's one of the kind of major U.S. cities for most of the United States' existence. It held the St. Louis World's Fair, for example, in 1904. So it was a pretty important place, especially when the river, the Mississippi River, which goes by it, was important. And as St. Louis, as the country grew bigger, obviously St. Louis declined somewhat. But I was born there, and I look back fondly on those days. It's a great place, very family friendly, lots of outdoors things to do. My family was pretty Catholic actually at the time, and so I went to kind of all Catholic grade schools and an all boys Catholic high school as well. So it's a bit of a St. Louis is a very Catholic city actually, with a lot of immigrants from Germany, a lot of Irish, places like that. So a long history of all boys and all girls Catholic schools. So that, you know, that was kind of my upbringing. And I guess one unique thing in high school that I did, which we were sort of talking about earlier, I believe, was study in Russia, actually. So I did spend 1 month of my junior year of high school, and then a full, I think it was 6 to 8 months of my senior year of high school, actually, over in Moscow. So that was kind of my focus in those days was languages and Russian language in particular. I think I was intrigued by the Tom Clancy novels of the 1980s, and our longtime foes there in the East kind of starting to shift as we go into the 90s into something new. And obviously in those days, nobody was quite sure what it was going to be. So I graduated high school. Funny enough, had my missed my prom. I was in Russia at the time. Came back and then I went to university at Georgetown, which is interestingly enough another Catholic Jesuit school in Washington D.C., where I did a 4-year degree in Russian, and so focused on that Russian area mm-hmm. studies. So you're doing everything from learning Russian itself, doing linguistics to writing long papers about things like War and Peace and stuff like that. So it was a pretty good experience. Yeah. Georgetown's kind of famous in the US for being the school that traditionally supplied a large number of diplomats. So if you wanted to be in the Foreign Service, you would go through Georgetown, and many of my friends were in that world. So it fit me quite well, I think, with my kind of international looking perspective and friends who were all studying, you know, whether it be Mandarin or Spanish or French, or it was all sort of pretty normal. And I found myself, I think, among like-minded individuals, many of which who are still good friends today. And while I was there, I actually had a scholarship. So I did a ROTC scholarship, which basically means that you go to classes with the military once or twice a week. They pay for a large chunk, if not all, of your degree, which, if anybody knows U.S. university costs, that can be pretty substantial. I mean, I think Georgetown now, it's just unbelievable. I think it's 200,000 plus or something like that. It's just unbelievably expensive. In those days, it wasn't quite that expensive, but the military still covered, the government covered a large chunk of that. And you owe them these sort of weekly classes. You go on a 1 month training course. That's like it's like the closest thing you get to a boot camp, basically. I went down to Florida for a month my junior year, and then you graduated as an officer, in my case, in the U.S. Air Force. You get a little bit of say, obviously, on what you do, although not completely. As I had said, funny enough, they paid me to study Russian, and then really never had much inclination to use that training. This was kind of right before 9/11, when the Middle Eastern situations were hopping up, and really all the focus was either on the Balkans or on the Middle East at that point. So I graduated, became a second lieutenant in the Air Force, and they promptly sent me to Omaha, Nebraska, where they told me to sit and wait. So very typical military type stuff, hurry up and wait, basically. And I was attached to a RC-135 rivet joint squadron. It's probably a plane you may have heard of, but many have not. It's a big civilian jetliner. It's a 707, and it flies around the world to interesting locales and sucks in signals of all kinds. And in fact, funny enough, some just were in the news the other day in the Black Sea, where a couple were flying behind some B-52 bombers that we sent in the area. So we used the B-52s to spook the Russians to launch a bunch of planes and turn on a bunch of radars. And then these rivet joints fly behind and suck all that data in and save it for future use. Let's put it that way. So I was attached to the squadron, got to know the pilots quite well, gave them sort of intel briefs, even though technically I really wasn't trained in it yet. In military affairs, had always been a hobby, and I knew the systems pretty well anyway. So this was just a matter of attaching classified information with non-classified information and giving it to them in PowerPoint and the like. And one thing I can say about my Air Force career is that you do a lot of PowerPoint. In fact, we used to joke that you get PowerPoint patches, actually, for 1 million slides, 2 million slides, 10 million slides, this kind of thing. Because that is what intelligence analysts do. You make a lot of PowerPoint. But it was good fun. And I was, like I said, I was really just waiting to go to what they call technical training, but was actually able to be pretty close to an active squadron, which was pretty neat. Then I went down to Texas, was down there for the actual training that they give you. So it was about a little bit less than a year. That was San Angelo, Texas, out west, kind of in the desert out there. That wrapped up in January 2001, interestingly enough. And my first assignment was Italy. So I got sent to a NATO base in Italy, where I was part of a very small team that was working with Brits, of course, and Italians and French and Germans. And we were doing the kind of tail end of the Balkans work, basically. So my job there was to fly over to Bosnia once a month or so, and to do inspections of Bosnian Serb air defense installations. So this was, like I said, quite a ways after the war. We basically wanted to allow the Bosnians to play with their toys, but we didn't want them turning their anti-aircraft weapons and radars against our aircraft, which obviously could create the incidents that you might not want. So we would send people like me out there. NATO would send people like me out there to stand around in the cold and often wet conditions and sort of monitor what they were doing. And we had a sat phone that kind of connected back to headquarters. And if anything ever kind of untoward was happening, then we could go shut it all down. That was basically it. But it was pretty cool. And I think it's probably the big advantage of the military experience is that they put young people like myself at the time, I was 21 or 22, in these positions of leadership where you're sent to international locations, kind of dropped on the ground. And so go accomplish the mission. So, you know, I think that is probably the biggest single advantage for your, for junior military people. You immediately meet, you know, general officers and all sorts of senior people and working closely with them, providing intelligence, for example, was a pretty great experience. So, so that was, and I was there, of course, when on September 11th, which obviously we've just celebrated the anniversary the other day.
Yep.
That changed everything, as you might imagine. I mean, it went from a pretty relaxed kind of let's float into the Balkans once in a while to all of a sudden everybody's wondering just how far this was all going to go. If you remember, we went into Afghanistan in October, so not long after. And like I said, everything was kind of a little bit different after that. So my Italian job there was closing down. So I was supposed to be there for like 2 years, didn't last that long. They were closing down the Balkans mission and moving it to Bologna, which is obviously farther in the south. And they kind of gave me a choice. Where do you want to go? I said, well, you know, I'd like to go to a more urban environment, perhaps, you know, maybe Shape up in Belgium, something like that. Let's see what's available. Italy might've been an option as well, but I ended up choosing Germany. So I went to the largest US Air Force installation there, which was Ramstein, which you might've heard of. It's got a massive hospital and it's really one of the single biggest kind of airfields left in Europe there. There used to be at the end of the Cold War, hundreds of airfields. And the idea, of course, was that the more the better, because it was difficult to destroy them all. But, you know, at this point, obviously for cost purposes, they've closed most of them. So they're all kind of consolidated in a couple of different places. So yeah, I went to Germany, which was good fun. And from Germany, I had a couple of interesting experiences. I got to deploy to Afghanistan for 6 months in 2002. So this was the spring after we invaded. By that point, things were pretty relaxed, I would say. And I actually had a pretty good experience. It was raw. There was no infrastructure. There was really no no luxury whatsoever. Later on, they built like basically a Walmart kind of thing there where people could, I mean, like a 60 aisle shopping center or something like that. I was there in the days when there was just tents basically. And but again, it was a pretty cool experience. Although a little bit like being in jail, I always say I was there to support the Air Force general and I gave him his kind of daily intelligence briefings. And otherwise, I exercised a lot and worked a lot because there wasn't a great deal else to do. We were coordinating things like drones, for example, and other intelligence assets, and just trying to make sure that our customers had kind of the information that they needed to do their jobs. So it was a pretty cool experience. The base was shelled every so often, but I mean, it was pretty inaccurate stuff, and the risks I think were pretty minor to me. So I was fairly lucky. I think later on things got obviously quite a bit nastier and a little bit more dangerous. But I only got to leave the base I think 3 times in 6 months, something like that. So it was a little bit like being in jail. It's a little bit like Groundhog Day. Honestly, you just do the same thing over and over and over. And obviously when you're 23, there's no drinking and there's no going to socialize or anything like that. So it is a little bit of a different experience. But again, I think one that does build a bit of character. So I did that, came back towards the end of the year, I think right before Christmas, and the military told me, well, you're going to go out again. And so this was, of course, in the build up to the invasion of Iraq. And so they sent me to Israel, where I got to work at the right outside the embassy in Tel Aviv there, which at a high level, what we were trying to do was just coordinate with the Israelis so that if Saddam was going to throw some more chemical, scuds, this time potentially with chemical weapons towards Tel Aviv, we wanted to make sure that the Israelis didn't act without coordination, or hopefully didn't act at all, was really the idea. So it was a big sort of intelligence sharing kind of effort there. And that was also very interesting. And as we all know from the invasion of Iraq itself, from a military point of view, it went pretty flawlessly, really. And ultimately was very smooth. Certainly the peace, we won the war much, much better than we won the peace. Let's put it that way. Much better than the politicians ended up winning the peace. So my job ended up being a bit anticlimactic. I mean, the invasion was over pretty quickly. Obviously the Iraqis were not a great opposition there. And I was able to see a little bit of Israel and then go back to Germany. So yeah, I think that was kind of my military experience. I mean, I think at this point, I was getting to the point where you have to make a decision. I was about 4 years in, 3 years in, and my commitment was about four. So I was probably 3.5 at that point. And you have to make a decision, I would just, whether you want to kind of continue to make this a career or not, or do other things. I was not a pilot, as I mentioned. I was really an analyst, which I always say, you know, I was trying, you know, it's really a bit like being a management consultant is probably the best way I could put it. to generals effectively. I mean, the general says, oh, you want to, you know, I need to know about weapons of mass destruction in Syria. Go do a bunch of research and give me a presentation, write a report, that kind of thing. And then maybe the next day you're supporting the evacuation of an embassy in Africa, for example. So it's a lot about getting a certain amount of depth and being flexible enough to jump around and deal with different situations. I was working, as I say, mostly in Germany. And so this is the headquarters of European Air Force Command, EUCOM as well, as down at Stuttgart. So it's all European and Middle Eastern focused stuff, and you'd have to be pretty flexible in dealing with it. So I enjoyed the day-to-day, but not being a pilot, you kind of have to ask yourself, what are your chances of really going forward in the Air Force? And the way the Air Force works is pilots run the show. They always have, and presumably until drones and pilot as planes take over, they probably always will. So if you fly planes, you have a bit of a sure or reasonably good chance of getting to a senior position. If you're anything else, but Intel in particular, you've got a bit of a glass ceiling, basically, and you'll always be in a bit of a supporting role, which frankly, we always found funny because as we were in intelligence, we often thought, well, you know, even at a young age, you're exposed to sort of grand level strategy. Obviously, if you're in intelligence, you've got that big picture that often a pilot doesn't have. If you think about it, if you're trained to fly an F-16, right, that's what you do. All you do is fly F-16s for it could be 15 years or something like that, right? So you don't have the big picture, funny enough, but you do have the magic wings. And so, of course, at the end of the day, and I think this is the same in most militaries, that plays a big role. I think it's the same thing, I think, in the Army in certain regards. If you're a tanker, for example, you may have certain advantages over if you're in IT or if you're in logistics and things like that. So very similar kind of thing. So long story short, I decided, well, I need to start looking at other things and also maybe I should use this Russian that I did all this training for. So I ended up separating, got out, and was looking to go to Moscow, funny enough. And as life kind of takes one of these weird turns, I ended up meeting my future boss at the time. These guys were running it was Titan Corporation and eventually L3 Communications. They were running a startup of a new contract. They had basically won a massive contract to provide intelligence services and classified IT stuff services around the Europe, basically. And they had won the contract, so they had to go in and hire existing staff. So they had the contract already existed, right? So they had to go and say, well, we're gonna retain maybe 50% of the staff, and 50% are just gonna go back to the US or leave, and we have to rehire. So I kind of walked into the middle of that. They were trying to recruit me to go do my old job, basically. They said, oh, you know, we'd love you to go do intelligence work, just put on a tie kind of thing. And I was kind of like, well, I just got out of that world, not super interested in going right back in with different clothing. So they kind of disappeared. And then a week later, they called me back and said, listen, can you help us with a startup? You know, we just need some manpower. We'd like to, maybe you could just help us for a couple of weeks and then move on. And one thing leads to another, and pretty soon you're doing, you know, I really hit it off with the guy I was working with. He was an ex Boeing engineer that had worked on Tomahawks for a long time, the missiles. He'd helped build planes. And funny enough, had lived in St. Louis for a while. So, you know, sometimes in life, you just sort of, these things happen. We really just got along well, and we started this contract out of his hotel suite, basically. So I ended up going for something I thought was temporary to actually doing this for a number of years. And it turned out to be a pretty good segue, because what it ended up being was a good step into the business world, but in an environment that I had just left, in the sense that I knew, you know, I knew the product. I had just been an intelligence officer. I knew actually IT quite well because of some historical having worked in it. And it ended up being probably a really good segue into business, because it allowed me to do that in a kind of measured way and get my feet a bit wet with dealing with Excel and financial forecasts and other things that, frankly, as an intelligence officer, you know, was not a big part of the job description. So,
sadly enough, Scott, I actually worked for L3 as well.
Oh, did you really? Oh, that's interesting. Where was this?
So we worked in the naval base up in Scotland.
Okay.
So we worked in
Is that False Lane?
False Lane, yeah. So it was submarine simulators.
Oh, fascinating. So,
that's bizarre. I'm just looking at your lights.
That is. No, I know False Lane well. One of the other kind of funny parts about my history is that I've always been slightly more interested in naval history than in the Air Force. It's not that I wasn't interested in airplanes or whatever. I am, but I actually always had a bit of a sweet spot for funny enough, submarines and for naval warfare more generally. And so when I got my scholarship, the Air Force deal was a better deal. So I ended up taking that one. But Yeah. Anyway, that is very interesting. You know, these contractors are everywhere. They have they're very big organizations. And
yeah, I think it's 70,000 worldwide.
Yeah, no, massive. And yeah. The amount of money involved is very big as well. And so what we were doing, like I said, is that it was like a startup mentality. And I think, you know, I think back today, like, how does this help you? But it's a lot like an AIM company in a sense. The difference here, you know, in the sense that you have to do everything. I mean, you have to do your own IT, you have to sort of do your own HR. You just don't have a lot of support. The difference with working for an L3 or a Titan. So this was Titan at the time that was later bought by L3 is of course that you have the sort of mother company back in the US. So you don't have to raise money for it and things like that. I mean, at least you have a certain amount of support coming in from overseas. But when you're out on the tip of the spear a bit, as they say, yeah, I mean, you're kind of out here having to do a lot of these things yourself without a big team. So yeah, it was pretty cool. I really enjoyed it. I think we opened six offices around Europe, five, six offices, and hired, I think, 600 people and staffed these contracts up. And I got to learn a lot about how, you know, government contracting works, how you apply for these things, how you win, lose, or otherwise get replaced in them from time to time. The government can decide, for example, that it wants small vendors to provide contracts because it wants to support small businesses, and it might give them huge advantages in bidding on contracts. And then things change dramatically. So it's an interesting world. It's a little bit of an enclosed, you know, playpen. Not everybody can compete in that space. Obviously, yeah. Contractors have huge advantages over, you know, but from anybody outside. I mean, like, it's difficult for some random, you know, I don't know, Italian company to compete for US classified contracts, right? It's just not that easy to do at the end of the day.
They were a great company to work for. So they were. The only reason I left was because I had an opportunity in business and I just thought, you know what, you only get one shot in life. I'm just going to go for it.
That was kind of my take. I mean, I really enjoyed it and it kept me away from, like I said, the kind of Russian experience that I wanted. But I also sat there and looked at myself and said, well, if I stay in this world now, I'll really have to go back to a place like Reston, Virginia. I need to go move back to the US and play politics. Not out here, quote unquote, at the tip of the spear where you're doing the contracts, but back where I hate to say it, but where the power is, where the, you know, where sort of the decision makers are. And it was not going to be the easiest thing in the world to transition from Germany at that point back to the US. I mean, I didn't necessarily want to move back at that point. I still had some hopes of doing something in Russia. And so I was looking at this situation. I'm saying, yeah, this has been super interesting, a little deviation from what I expected. So this would have been sort of 2005, 2006 at this point. But business is booming, as we all know. These were good years in business. And I'm saying, yeah, there's, you know, maybe there's some other things to do. So I applied for a dual MBA program that was part London Business School in London and part Columbia Business School in New York. It's called the EMBA Global Program. And I thought, well, I'm going to hedge my bets here. I've got a European school that can really cover my bases there. And obviously any place that the UK or the English have been active overseas, LBS tends to have a good reputation, including all the Commonwealth countries and things. And then also I've got a New York school if I do decide to go back and take a look at that. And so I ended up embarking on that program. It's a really, really interesting program. It's as we used to joke in the program, it's 2 degrees for the price of three. It's not cheap, but you do get the sort of, you get full degrees from both programs, which I think a lot of these hybrid deals don't work. I mean, a lot of times you're doing it all online and you kind of get a certificate and, you know, it's not quite the same thing. So I took the GMAT went and got in and ended up doing the kind of the full deal. It's a lot of flexibility as well. Technically it's an executive deal. So you do the first year in block weeks. So they'll, you know, you fly yourself to London, and you do say 10 days there, and then you go back to work for a couple of weeks, and then you go to New York next month and back and forth and back and forth. That's the first year. Second year, you do whatever you want. And that's where the kind of real flexibility came in. I actually moved to London at that point, figuring, well, that seems to be the place I like the most. I didn't want to go back to the US yet, as I mentioned. And I was actually able to get into some other things, which is how I began to actually get into AIM and the world of which we're all familiar with these days. So I ended up working for a hedge fund at that time called Yorkville Advisors, which was a kind of very controversial at the time entity that was doing different types of debt and equity structured fundings for small cap companies. And so I was part of a new team. The UK office at that time had really just opened up a couple of months, basically. And so everybody was just trying to figure out how it worked. What was the best way to get clients? What was the lay of the land? What stock exchanges could these types of things be done on? It was a fascinating experience. And I was able to do that kind of alongside my schooling. So I was taking corporate finance, taking advanced corporate finance, taking hedge funds, you know, all at Columbia or LBS. Taking different sort of investing courses while having the experience of being able to do these things here in London, which was pretty interesting. And it was my first real experience with AIM companies, with AIM CEOs, with natural resources as well. And we were chasing different mining companies. We were chasing some companies in natural gas, for example, and even cement. So it was a pretty good experience, and really introduced me, I guess, for the first time to the world of AIM, interestingly enough. So then I left, actually, and did another year or so doing corporate finance at a small boutique that was doing kind of sell side M&A, pre-IPO type capital raises, and mostly private equity fundings. And that was really interesting as well. Again, very small team. We did things like working. We had a big client in North Africa that was selling a fast moving consumer goods type business. We had another client down in Spain that was doing glass manufacturing, for example. And again, it's really interesting to be able to see what kind of how you stick these businesses together with other ones, what kind of investors like these types of businesses, and it was, I think, a practical use of the MBA experience in the sort of corporate finance world. So yeah, it was very interesting, and that all kind of happened while the MBA was ongoing, and then I graduated. And of course, as we all know, that would have been, that would have been May 2009, something like that. And we all know what was happening right around that time. And that was the financial crisis. So, I just spent a rather large amount of my own money. I was not supported at all by L3 or anybody else. I chose that, of course. I mean, that was in part because I didn't want to be restricted when I got out. And unfortunately, that bet turned into a bit of a mess, in the sense that, as we all know, the world economies were crashing, and it became very difficult, especially for somebody like me who's really kind of in the middle of a career change at that point, to get a lot of traction. So hiring, was kind of collapsing, and even really experienced people were having trouble or otherwise giving up on, at my class, for example. We had 75 people, and a certain number of those, I think, were looking to do new things when they came out of the MBA. And most of them, I'll be honest, gave up, because it just wasn't viable unless you were going to sit around for a while. So I was lucky enough, though, having no family at the time or no real restrictions, I just said, well, maybe I'll take a bit of time off and use this experience to study or to travel a bit. So I did. I had not, all my military time had been in Europe, as I said, in the Middle East. And so I ended up going out to Asia for a while. I had a friend who was living in Saigon at the time. He was working at the U.S. embassy there, and he said, "Yeah, they've given me this huge flat. But you might as well come hang out." And so I did, and it was really great. And I was able to kind of use Ho Chi Minh City, Saigon, as a base, and tour a bit more of Asia and some other places I hadn't really spent all that much time. Indonesia and Thailand and all these different places, and it was really good. And it helped me kind of cover some of that time while the world economy licked its wounds and things improved. And then I spent a bit of time in Moscow, actually, at the end of that, where I was, again, kind of really trying to see what the angles were. I found, again, Moscow was tough going. It was, these emerging markets were really struggling from the effects of the crisis. I think, I always say it's a little bit like a pond, I think, where you throw a rock in the lake, and the waves come out from the center, and they hit New York, they hit London first, and then the waves kind of hit the emerging markets later. And that's kind of what it felt like in Moscow. So even though it was a year on, expats were all kind of closing up shop. They were all leaving. Russian companies were like, oh, we really only want locals now. We don't really want international people. Whereas just 2 years earlier, they were, they had been desperate for talent, really, at that point. They were, I think the market was super hot, as we all remember, 2006, 2007. And the Russian market in particular under Putin was just amazing. And then it went from amazing to disastrous. So anyway, long story short, I started just kind of figuring and getting more indications that London was going to have more opportunities. Over a period of time, I kind of come back for interviews and things like that. And I was eventually introduced to Andrew Bell over at Regency and Red Rock. And these two companies were on AIM at the time and had gone through a massive upswing. So they had gone from being a couple of million each to, I think, Red Rock was worth 130 million pounds, something like that, and Regency was worth 40. So this was a group that was kind of pushing 170 million and looked like it was going to be huge, really huge. And so I got to know Andrew a bit and found him really interesting guy, obviously very well read and kind of fascinating to listen to. And it seemed like he needed help, obviously needed help on the management side. I mean, it was a situation where they had grown very quickly and the management of the company hadn't really grown to match it yet. There had been some hiring, but it wasn't fully organized. And he was interested in some help in the finance, because obviously when you're going through that kind of growth phase, you're raising money all the time. You're constantly refinancing debt. It's just a constant part of the business. Whereas maybe when you're a startup, it's something you do a couple times a year kind of thing. So I came in and kind of got down to it and found it kind of sort of fascinating, really. I mean, if you look at what the companies were doing at the time, Red Rock was focused mostly on gold. And I think within a week of my showing up, Andrew had done a deal to put Red Rock into iron ore in Greenland, which was just fascinating to me at the time. It was sort of just to learn and be able to be exposed to the beginning of an exploration program from literally the conception to going out there and doing work. So when I started, I had no idea how long I would stay or how it would work, but I thought it was a good way to get some experience. These were clearly businesses that needed some help on a variety of levels, in the sense that, again, they had grown fast and needed to kind of catch up. And it looked like kind of an exciting thing to get my teeth into. And as these things do, it turned out to be something, again, a bit different than I expected. Both companies went on for about a year and a half or so after that, doing pretty well. And then the markets, as we all know, kind of started to tank 2013, 2014. If you were an explorer, which both these companies were, and you really hadn't been able to convert anything into production, then you were going to suffer. And so something, when I started, investors were looking at what was in these companies and they were extrapolating them all out as positively as they could. So if you had a gold asset, you would assume it's going to go into production in 3 years and it's going to produce X number of ounces. If you had, say the iron asset in Greenland, for example, you make the same assumptions. You say, well, this is going to be a mine in X years and this is what the NPV of it is today. And then within 2 years, the markets are turning those same things and they're saying, that's a JORC resource. That's just a money pit. That's worth negative value. And I'm sure you guys are familiar with it, but I mean, it was fascinating to see people look at exactly the same assets having been advanced and making such radically different assumptions about them, And again, that you learn a lot when you go through these kind of experiences, how these things work.
Yeah, it's all market sentiment. So it's bizarre how these cycles work, but you're 100% right. Yeah, but just...
In those days too, the other thing I'd say is that was the tail end of the Chinese boom. I mean, I think the other thing I remember everybody saying at the time was that the Chinese are going to be so big and they're going to eat so many of the world's minerals that anything you can bring to JORC or advanced JORC, BFS, will be put into production. And again, that's a bit of rose-colored glasses in retrospect, of course. But there was this tinge that anything realistic would ultimately be put into production. And as we know, over the last decade or so, that just has not been the case. I mean, the key factors that make deposits attractive, whether it be grade, location, logistics, these other sorts of details, all of which were largely being ignored in those boom days, do matter, as it turns out, and probably should, frankly. And so, I learned, and I certainly can't say enough about the period. I know it's been an up and down period for investors of the two companies, obviously, but I sort of went from a fairly junior employee who, like I said, was really focused on the corporate finance side, to ended up having to put my MBA hat on and reduce the size of the company significantly. So my somewhat thankless task was to, I ended up having to let go, I think we let go 18 people or something like that, which is never a pleasant sort of thing to do, especially when it's not because of performance or anything, obviously. I mean, these were geologists who worked their butts off, who helped us get things like JORC Resources successfully. And then you just kind of have to say, well, I know you guys have done a great job and really haven't gotten a great deal financially out of it, but now we have to let you go, kind of thing. And it was challenging, to say the least. And that task was sort of ongoing 2015, 2016. We closed the accounting departments and let them all go. And we really shrank these businesses back down to their cores. We tried, we did everything we could to hold on to the assets, because of course that seemed to be the sensible thing to do. I mean, if there was something to be sold, it was sold. In fact, if you remember, Red Rock did sell its gold mine asset at that point, because that was a saleable asset. But some of the exploration stuff, you realize Swift are going to have to hold it through the cycle. They were not going to be saleable until things improved a bit. So it's really about stabilizing the ship. I mean, it's such a different experience, again, from a 180 million pound group that looks like it's going to be a 500 million pound group to then being a sort of 10 million pound one entity and the other, you know, other one being a couple of million pounds. And then continuing on from there, it both companies shrank even further. So again, it's you learn a lot. That's all I can say. When you shrink the company down, you don't have the specialists doing absolutely every bit of it. Then you find yourself doing the IT. Again, I have a bit of a background in that. So, you know, in a company like this, if we bought a new computer, it was Scott doing the formatting and putting Office on there and setting up Outlook. I mean, that's the kind of stuff you get into because you have to. Because what's the point of paying some outsourced consultant, you know, a grand to do this kind of work if you can do it inside?
Yeah.
You know? You're already doing all the IR, the PR. We're already doing the financial modeling, you know, so you bring it all of it inside and just sort of shrink back, cut the cost as much as possible and try to hold on, you know, for better days. And I think we can say that it was worth it. I mean, I know, you know, the journey hasn't been perfect on all sides, but both companies now, obviously Regency now in its new form of Corcel, and Red Rock in its current form have made it through and now appear to be on the upswing. I mean, Red Rock, which I'm not obviously nearly as involved in as I was, I'm still helping around with some of my, I mean, obviously I have a long history there, especially on the finance side. So I do a bit of work there on the side, but Regency and Red Rock's done well, I guess is my point. I mean, I think holding on to the gold assets, obviously it's proven to be a bit of a boon. Gold is about as high as it gets at the moment. And I think nearly all of what was created during the better days has been retained and advanced. And so now that's starting to kind of be recognized again. Yeah. And on the Regency side, obviously the story is a little bit more interesting, but I think what we've done over the last year in taking the core of what was left in Regency, which we saw to be the nickel cobalt asset in New Guinea, the battery metal aspect to it, and the energy storage and energy production side, which you know, credit to Andrew, he created this subsidiary called ESTEC back in the day, which was designed to add that kind of that sort of business unit to Regency as it was at the time. That's been retained and now pushed forward under this sort of new team effectively over the last year. So I guess we could segue into that if you want. I mean, it's been an interesting run. I think obviously there was a lot of turmoil around the company in 2019 with Andrew stepping aside for a while. And personally, obviously I had some choices to make. I mean, in the story I've just told you, I mean, I had been part of these entities and of Regency for a long time and obviously had to decide whether it made sense to stay, frankly, or not. Mm. I mean, I it wasn't a no-brainer, let's put it that way. I can understand how different people might view that differently. But, you know, from my point of view, you put your sort of, put an awful lot of effort into things for a certain amount of years, and you have to make a decision, is it time to go do something else or not? And obviously I felt, even though I wasn't running Regency in its prior incarnation, I was a big part of it, or I was certainly a part of it anyway. I mean, working for the founder. And I felt an obligation to shareholders to potentially help, you know, if I thought I could. And as it turned out, I kind of, you know, did a little bit of introspection and looked at what we had in the business last year and said, you know, I think there's more than enough to build around here, and I think we can run with this. So I then spent last summer working on putting a new board together. I brought in Ewan Ainsworth and Nigel Burton, who are kind of generalists. They have a bit of an oil and gas background, but were a lot of experience in companies going through these kind of transitions. And I think that was exactly what was needed at the time, were people who were going to sort of take the big picture view as to where we were, where we could go. You know, I met with them on numerous occasions, kind of pitched them on what I thought was in Regency at the time and how we could potentially drive it forward. And I think they shared my view. I mean, I think they, if you think about their decisions, I mean, I had the history with the company, obviously. So after, I mean, after there was a period, as we know, that we had Regency had no CEO and no chairman. It was effectively headless. And so again, I had to make a decision to sort of stay involved, stay in the boat. And these two gentlemen had to make a decision to get in the boat at that point. And it was, you know, it's not a no-brainer decision for them. I mean, certainly they're not getting in for immediate financial gain, let's put it that way. Nor was I probably staying in for that purpose. It was really because I think we jointly thought that there was a real core of value here and that we could drive this thing into something really exciting.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting mix. Obviously, the three guys that come in are predominantly oil and gas background, but the company's, you know, focused in battery metals and energy transition.
Yeah.
It's interesting, but strange at the same time.
It's a bit, like I said, I would consider it a bit of an accident. Or you may argue, you know, when we talk about James Parsons coming in, obviously, as he did towards the end of the year, I mean, he is coming in with sort of the capstone to the thing, because it gave us the impetus to refinance our debt. I mean, that was the sort of that last vestiges from some of our Regency's early investments, including it had borrowed a bit of money to do a couple of coal transactions, one and neither of which, unfortunately, were very successful. So, you know, we thought there was a core of value in the business, but the debt had to be sorted. And so I met James in the autumn and again, pitched him the same concept. This was after you and Nigel were already in. And I think, you know, you ask, how do these oil and gas guys get in? I think honestly, and I know for the fact in James's case, it's because, you know, they also see the writing on the wall. I mean, oil and gas is a sector in transition at the moment. And I think James personally would wanted to diversify his exposure a bit, which makes total sense. And I suspect you would say the same thing for you and Nigel to some extent, although they're not as pure play oil and gas. They certainly have a lot of experience in the sector. But I think we all collectively thought that energy, you know, this energy transformation, I mean, the decarbonization of the global economy that everybody talks about is huge. And it's gonna have all these knock-on effects that we want to be in the middle of. And I'm not sure an oil and gas company can do that. I mean, a company that offers battery metals in the ground and at the same time, you know, mixes that with these power sites, these energy storage sites. Now that's a company that seems to straddle where things are going, right? And I think when you meet somebody like James, who obviously he was kind of wrapping up some of his experiences with Sound and some other things, and he's saying, you know, where do I want to be going forward? I think, you know, he would tell you, you know, that there was a great deal of logic in this. And that's why, again, we thought that even though there were some challenges in the Regency vehicle and what needed to be done, we all thought this was a no-brainer to go for it, to go, you know, give it a go, put the time in, get it restructured. And then ultimately, as we've done now this year, get it rebranded and get on with things. And so, you know, Andrew did leave last September, and that was obviously a bit sad in some regards, but I think, you know, that, you know, there was no hard feelings whatsoever. I think there were obviously always going to be elements of the markets that that want to hold somebody responsible for the history a little bit, right? And it's the nature of these things, and probably it's how things should work to some extent. I mean, there has to be a level of responsibility. So at this point, yeah, by December, we had built the new board now with the four of us. We had cleaned up the company, raised some money, and now we're really getting in back to the projects. It was, you know, instead of being the kind of a little bit of theater that was playing out over 2019, it was really back to reality a bit. And and we were ready to hit the ground running. And then, of course, COVID hit.
COVID hit, yeah.
Hasn't been the biggest problem for us. But of course, I mean, you can't say that it's not without some disruption. I mean, we can't go to PNG, for example. I mean, like, you know, we were able to sneak a trip out to Australia right before this all happened. In fact, we were probably right in the middle of some of the airlines flying COVID all around the world, but we were lucky enough not to get it. And since then, obviously, we've been pretty shut down on our travel. Now, you know, as far as how we run this business, as I kind of said earlier, we never really built it back up. It's been run very leanly for 4 or 5 years now. With minimal of sort of permanent office space, there's just no needs for these things. We're in a WeWork, for example. You know, you need a mailing address. You know, we've got our computers and our screens and our other bits and bobs, where those things are don't matter a great deal. So COVID honestly hasn't hurt us in a sort of day-to-day sense, but it probably makes it a bit difficult to progress some of these more interesting transactions. I mean, one in particular that obviously anybody who follows the company has paid attention to this year is the WoWo Gap transaction. I mean, that was our attempt to build something much more meaningful in PNG, to build a regional nickel player that doubles down on the sort of nickel as a battery metal that we all think is really compelling over the next couple of years. I mean, nickel's had a bad run. It's 10 years or so. I mean, really, when I joined Regency, we were just kind of topping off the JORC resource out at Mumbari. And I'll never forget, I mean, we announced this JORC. It was a really sizable JORC resource. And the price went down. You know, you're kind of like, seriously? So you just, you know, we proved that there's a massive amount of nickel and cobalt out there. And the market yawns and said, no, you're going to have to spend more money. We don't like you. It's kind of like, okay, that's how it's going to be. So that's, you know, nickel's been unpopular for a while. And there's been a couple of, you know, little blips here and there, the Indonesian, you know, nickel export ban and some other things, but it's been pretty poor. And then,
Actually, Scott, I actually found a post from 2010 in ADVFN.
Yes.
And it was There must have been some beer involved, but I'd actually sat and worked out. This was before you'd released the jock for Mumbari, and yep. I sat and worked, tried to work it out. So I did, and I came up with 2.7 million tons, and I think you guys came out with 1.7 or 1.75.
Yep, that sounds about right. Yeah.
So I was like, well, I was a bit out, but no, it was quite interesting because it just popped up the other day, and it was near enough 10 years old. Obviously back in the day, I was quite heavily invested in Regency.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's what I always tell people. I mean, this project alone underpinned a 40 million pound valuation at one point. Now, we can say, yeah, those were a little bit different times, but even if it's a fraction of that, I mean, I would argue, and again, I say this constantly because we all know every CEO thinks they're undervalued, but I mean, I really do think the core of Mumbari itself probably justifies a multiple of where we are today. Just based on the nickel and cobalt alone.
Yeah, right? So. It's just 3% drilled as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, people forget that. I mean, the drilling history, of course, is you drill where there's easiest access, right? So the team back in 2008 to 10 to 11 was drilling on the slopes. And that's partly because it was a little easier to get to at the time and a little less expensive. But the plateau has always been viewed as the higher grade area. And yeah, that's 3% drilled out. So when the time comes and it makes sense to drill that out, I mean, this thing, you know, really could be huge, really massive. And I think, you know, the history of nickel over the last 10 years, and then, as I say, some of the, you know, the twists and turns that Regency took kind of made people just forget about that or not take it too seriously. I mean, our partners, it probably doesn't help that our partners, Direct Nickel at the time, also kind of had their own issues. They went into a form of administration in part, not because of Mumbari, but because that they were unable to advance their technology assets very far. So, you know, that's a bit of a sad story as well. They had a couple of opportunities along the way to raise money, and ultimately, I think, were probably trying to defend a certain valuation. And unfortunately, one thing led to another, led to borrowing some debt out. And ultimately that business kind of became a different one, really. And we now have a new version of them out there. There's some overlap in the personnel, of course, but it's sort of a new entity. So that didn't help us either, but it just shows you how difficult the period has been. I mean, these guys were a nickel pure play with a pretty fantastic technology that is ideal for these kinds of deposits. And they just weren't able to get traction because the mining industry said, you know, we're just not that interested in what you have to do. First of all, they said, prove it, that it works. They proved that it worked in a test plant. And then they said, well, we're not going to be first, you know, because that's how the industry works, sadly. So anyway, you know, it's been a bit of a soap opera, unfortunately. But I think if somebody just, if you take a look at it today, at the cold reality of that jork, that deposit and the potential, combine it with what we're trying to do with WoWo Gap, which is really take something a little bit smaller, a little bit higher grade, and potentially make it into something really big. You know, it doesn't take any kind of back of the envelope math to start to see that looking pretty large. Now, obviously the WoWo transaction is still in progress. I mean, I can't say too much more about what we're doing. We know there's an option coming due here in the near term. But I can say, and we have said that, you know, discussions are ongoing and that I think everybody's interests are aligned in the sense that everybody sees the logic in doing what we're looking to do here. And I do think COVID has hurt this a bit. You know, that's probably the one thing COVID has slowed down. I think this kind of thing, especially a sort of a bigger transaction like that, is a little harder to do when you can't sit across the table. Zoom is pretty good. Certainly it's fine enough for running the project, for example. We have, you know, there's no problem in running the project on the ground with Zoom. But when you need to do these kind of bigger transactions and really suss out the motivations of people, how you're going to work together, obviously the WoWo deal comes with a group called Sinom out of China, who's a potential big off-taker of a combined entity like that. They're a big shareholder of RMI. So, you know, you can start to see how the bits line up, both with our existing project and with the potential to get the second project into the mix in some form.
So what would be the advantages then?
Well, I think the short-term ones are simply not having two overheads. So you think about it, right? I mean, we've got two public companies, one in Australia, one in London, running two separate operations that are not that far apart with two separate teams in PNG, two separate sets of planning, two separate sets of lobbying, two separate sets of dealing with locals on the ground. So combine all that into one optimized set. Think about the next time you go meet the PNG government, for example. How's that going to be? You're going to be saying, now I'm speaking for two projects. I mean, again, hypothetical. I mean, I don't want to speak before something is done, but I think it can show you what our vision is. I don't think there's a problem with talking about the vision here. sitting down with the PNG government and saying, look, we can potentially create jobs in two different provinces. What about the tax revenues? What about, you know, what is this going to do to the local economies where it's going to, you know, there's a substantial amount of potential money going in there. You're going to be taken more seriously. You're going to be able to have a better chance to get what you want. And I'm not saying we couldn't get Mombari done on our own. I mean, we've been moving towards the mining lease now for the better part of a year. And that also may be COVID related, of course. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, the processing of a mining lease through a bureaucracy like that's not going to be sped up by COVID. That's just a reality. But, you know, I think we feel we could get it done by itself. So I don't want to say that we're dependent on something happening with WoWo. But I think if it doesn't take a genius to see the logic in putting the two together, the synergies that might be realized in having these two teams combined into one. We don't have particular interests. I think it's fair to say in the ASX side of it. So, you know, don't rule anything out, but I mean, I don't think that's likely to be involved. So the idea, you know, always has been to take the debt position, to potentially increase the debt position so that we have substantially all of the debt of the business, and then to work out a deal with the shareholders of RMI, of which the largest one is the debt holder. So, you know, you're kind of having a conversation already with the right people just by dealing with the debt, if that makes sense. Not everybody, of course, but certainly one of the largest ones. And then you've got a shareholder like Sinom, who's already a shareholder of Corcel, a pretty decent sized one, who's a potential off-taker and who wants to see these things, you know, turbocharged basically. Because if you look at their view, their story is very similar to the Mombari story. The WoWo Gap project has basically been sitting there for the same decade that the Mombari project has. So we feel the timing's right. I mean, rather than let these things languish, which, you know, there's just no excuse for them doing at this point, let's see if we can put them together, make a regional nickel player. And frankly, that's going to be something really substantial. And I think right where it needs to be to start to fill the gap of nickel as nickel becomes the battery metal that we all know it, you know, it's destined to be. I mean, nickel is so critical to making batteries dense, to making them have, you know, to making your EV have the range it needs to have for you to drive, you know, the 400 plus miles that most people demand on sort of cross-country trips, for example. It's an important part of making our consumer devices last longer. So nickel is going from a side project in a lithium ion battery to really mainstream. And you see that with the new chemistries that Teslas and others are pushing out to the market. Yeah. So
if it's going to happen.
Go ahead.
Yep. So I was just saying, if you look at the actual percentage of nickel used in the EV world at the moment, it's still pretty small. It's still really
point I would make, people say, like, well, is your nickel going to go to battery manufacturers? And of course, the argument is it doesn't need to. All you need is for some nickel to come out of the system, you know, the nickel that may or may not be optimized for it. And any other nickel has to be backfilled then. Otherwise, you have massive increases in prices, stainless steel, all the other traditional uses of nickel then become under pressure. So, you know, we've never really said that these have to become a direct export into the battery supply chain. They don't. They just need to be part of the process, basically part of the overarching, you know, supply chain of nickel as a whole. And so, yes, I mean, our sort of analysis and research shows demonstrably that nickel is going to be under pressure from a variety of different areas, not just batteries. Batteries is part of it. The other aspect to it, of course, is nickel sulfides are running out. Places like Norilsk, I mean, all these traditional deposits that have done the majority of nickel exports in the world and are very lucrative because they have massive byproduct credits are running out, and they're just not finding enough nickel sulfide deposits anymore, which is why deposits like this, like our Mombari one, and potentially the one we hope to get involved with more directly in WoWo are so important. So, you know, you can start to piece it together. You know, I think our view is that this is a very exciting sort of near-term play. You know, and I think, in my view, COVID and the changes to the world economy are only like to accelerate that. I think I think governments are going to spend an awful lot of money on green energy, on trying to put their stimulus into areas that are likely to push more battery technology into all forms of, you know, like truck transportation. Trains obviously are already electric to some extent, and light vehicles. And so there's just, you know, if you listen to the automotive manufacturers, they say we would like to produce more EVs already, but we can't get enough supply. It's already a problem, and it's not going to take much to push these commodities over the edge. And so our goal all along has been to get a hold of these assets before they run, obviously, not chase the hot thing of the day. We're not going to reinvent ourselves as a gold play tomorrow just because gold is hot for a few minutes. And, you know, we want to set ourselves up for long-term growth and success. And that's really what this is about. That doesn't mean we're not going to have short-term success, but I mean, it's about making sure that the long-term story is where it needs to be. And so, yeah, I think.
Yeah, just obviously, same the nickel side of things, Scott. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Corcel's got a few other strings to their bow as well. Can you just maybe touch quickly on the vanadium sure. side of
things? Yeah, the vanadium, exactly. That's our other battery metal. So when we talk about what we're offering investors, it's nickel cobalt out in New Guinea and then vanadium at the moment in Canada. So this is a project that was picked up sort of end of 2018. It is a very early stage exploration asset in the Yukon, has a lot of interesting advantages to it. It's located alongside a major highway, for example. It's got 20 kilometers of potential strike, and it's a black shale type deposit, which if you go look at what some other US entities are developing in, say, Nevada, for example, you see that these black shale deposits are ideal. They really favor low-cost mining and processing, actually, and are pretty attractive. So you kind of know that if you get this right, it's likely to, if you get it right and it's big enough and the grade shorts out, that you're going to be able to process it. It should be economic, which is pretty interesting. This project had a number of drill core samples left over. So it had seven holes from a 2006 exploration program that a different nickel entity was doing back in the day. We were able to get a hold of those and reprocess them for vanadium. And they look pretty compelling. So when you look at like the logistics of it, yeah, Yukon is pretty isolated, but there's a major road there. There are some towns within relatively easy distance. So it's the kind of thing that looks like the bits line up that if it works, you know, like I said, it could be a proper asset and be potentially put into production. We said, you know, when we looked at ourselves last year and obviously early this year, we said, you know, should we make this part of the mix? And it just fits perfectly as a battery metal. We think the vanadium redox flow batteries are, I mean, that's a battery metal in itself, and that they have a bright future of their own, a little bit different than lithium ion, obviously. Relatively low cost, more industrial, but so many charge cycles. I mean, you can certainly see how these vanadium redox flow batteries have their place in the mix because they could just be charged endlessly without running out. And
you can actually take the vanadium back out of these systems and reuse
it. That's right. And reuse it. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Exactly. They're fascinating. I mean, they're so different, obviously, in the way lithium works. But you know, and there's some other companies, obviously, on AIM that are doing vanadium and doing Red T, for example, that's making these types of batteries. I mean, we think that this is a market that it's battery metals, but obviously a little bit independent from the lithium side of things. And that's partly why we like it, because I think it just gives you a different, as you say, arrow in the quiver here for us to sort of, you know, lay on. So we went and did some work out there on this late August. And the team went out, collected samples. We also reprocessed some of the drill core, and that's kind of all these core pulps, actually. That's all actually at the lab at the moment. We've actually roped in a group from McGill. That's a PhD team that is actually specializing in these black shale deposits. And I mean, I have to say off the record, they're pretty positive. I mean, they have seen a lot of these kind of things. And when you're sort of technical guys, you know, start to use certain adjectives like, you know, never seen this before, super compelling, blah, blah, blah. You know, that kind of piqued our ears up a little bit. Again, it doesn't sort of replace the need to go do the test in the lab. It doesn't mean we won't have to drill it out, obviously. But when you get experts in the field saying that this is something different than they've seen before and very positive, obviously that gets us a bit excited. So it was relatively low cost exploration. That work is now done, like I said, being processed, and we hope to have some news on that as soon as the labs are ready. The unfortunate part, of course, being that Canada has been overwhelmed with demand because there's been a bit of a mining boom there over the last year or so. So things are not probably as quick as we might hope in Canada, but we look forward to getting those results. And the plan there is to use that to plan a 2021 drill campaign out there, where you would start to be talking about resources. I mean, that's really about taking this from that really early stage to something that you can really hang your hat on and talk about the fine metal in the ground and how we make it into something producing. So that's a Dempster Vanadium. And then beyond that, it really gets into our flexible grid solutions side. And again, I, you know, this is something we really created. And again, fair play to our ex-chairman, Andrew, created about 18 months ago, maybe 2 years ago now. And the idea was to pair the mining assets with a part of the business that has a very different risk reward profile. And we had been looking at a couple different projects, and you know, some of which were relatively early stage. And I think we've now settled on one that we're, that we feel really meets our needs. And you know, we're considering different things on this side, everything from gas peakers to big batteries, big battery sites, sometimes with both. So you might have both on site, sometimes combined heat and power type systems. That's, you know, that's where you might export heat and power directly to a client. So it could be like an Amazon warehouse that needs heat, for example, and you pump it to them and give them a reasonable power tariff, but good for all sides, obviously. As well as solar. Solar is the other aspect that we're kind of envisaging these guys, that side of our business looking at. And I would just say that, you know, one of the reasons we like it is because it just fits so perfectly with what the UK government wants to do. I mean, if you look at Boris's UK Net Zero 2050 initiative, yeah, I mean, this is where the government wants to be, you know, growing infrastructure. They want to go to renewables. We're not building new coal stations. Obviously, we are trying to get some nuclear stations out, but I mean, that's such a slow and painful process at this point. So baseload, as we know it, is going away. And what does that mean? I mean, that means that you've got to have flexible power and flexible storage solutions. I mean, it's a bit of, you know, it sounds like a bit of a cliche maybe, but that's exactly what they are. I mean, we are going to have to build more and more of these here across the UK, and not just in the UK. If you look at Australia, of course, building massive batteries. There was an article the other day in Bloomberg about California doing the same thing. This is going to happen everywhere. And so we looked at this last year, as I said, it had been sort of, incubated, but not fully nurtured. And we said, you know, this really should be a part of CoreCell going forward. And we've kind of settled now on this first project, which is the Burwell site. So this is up near Cambridge. It's a 30 megawatt plus energy storage project. There may be a chance to put some solar on the site as well. It's all basically farmers' fields up there. And we basically, the team that we've invested in, Weirs Drove, has ins with most of the local farmers. And they're all pretty keen about the idea of getting these installations on their property. We are in the process right now of getting the final bits lined up with the land lease, with the grid connection and the planning. And once you've done that, you're at what you call shovel-ready status, and then you go off and fund it. And one thing I would emphasize, always try to, of course, is that that these things are funded at the SPV level. So it's not that CoreCell has to go raise $10 million or something like that, right? I mean, we will be pitching this project at the SPV level to the types of investors that want these industrial returns. And for clarity, I mean, industrial return so the way I'm using it is a sort of 7 to 15 to maybe at the high side, a little higher than that, 16-17% return, right? I mean, depending on exactly what we're talking about. Whereas I think a junior mining company on AIM, I mean, cost of capital is probably higher still, right? I mean, I think you're really expected to hit very high returns when you're sort of a junior miner. So we like the idea of combining the two, and we certainly know that we shouldn't be borrowing money that's demanding 20% returns and pitching it into something that needs 10%, you know, something like that, or 12%, whatever it ends up. But that's the appeal. The appeal is that you have investors, different groups that want that kind of safe, solid, repeating return. And those are the kind that we intend to bring in, alongside some debt, of course, into the SPV for this first project.
Yeah, I know it's one of the projects is it Southport, Scott?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, is that the same site that ECTEC had?
Yes, it is. It is. Yeah. So Southport's an interesting one. So again, when ECTEC was founded, we were introduced to the gang up at Southport. There's a group up there that has a current waste facility. And we've been kind of talking to them on and off right up through COVID, basically. And the bottom line there is that their interest at a macro level is in the waste side. The existing landowner has a waste business. And what he wants to do is open a biogas, waste to energy site. That's the focus, right?
Yeah.
Our focus has really always been on the batteries and the gas aspect of it, the gas generation aspect of it. So we want to put a peaker up there, basically. And so, you know, what would happen when you're starting to talk about it is you find, well, you know, the leaseholder wants a much bigger, I would argue, slightly more risky site, right, that has a biogas plant on it. We kind of wanted to get our feet wet with the peaker and then maybe look at the biogas later. And so I think as it's turned out is that, yeah, ECTEC, because their specialty is biogas, has ended up being a fit for those guys that, I mean, frankly, we couldn't offer. You know what I mean? It's nothing to be embarrassed about, I don't think, on our side. I mean, they are biogas experts. That's what they do. They have special technology in that area. And so the deal that the guys at Southport have signed, you know, it seems like a totally reasonable MOU to be signing with those guys. And so funny enough, you know, once that became public, we've reached out to ECTEC because we potentially would like to continue to be interested, you know, especially on the gas and battery side, which I gather at least at a high level, ECTEC doesn't, you know, that's not quite their focus. So yeah, it's just one of these things where you got to be flexible. I mean, I think it's a very good site. I think we thought it had a lot of potential. I think the deal that has been done certainly involves terms and other aspects to it that fit ECTEC a lot better than it fits Corcel. And I think, you know, being flexible like we need to be, we continue to explore the angles there to see how we may all work together. I mean, I know ECTEC has a lot of other things going on. They've raised a bit of money. And I happen to know the CEO reasonably well, obviously, because we're, to some extent, we are overlapping a bit now. So we're going to, you know, we're slated to meet this week. And we look forward to seeing what we could potentially do do together. But that's the kind of flexibility you need on these things. There are a lot of these sites out here. There are a lot of, well, you can get distracted running down too many angles. I mean, obviously you have to decide where to focus your time and effort. And I think on Southport, it became clear that biogas was the focus and fair play, right? I mean, so.
Yeah, we're home to get David Blumbone.
Yes, David, exactly. David is an excellent guy. He's done a great job out there. I mean, certainly he's been able to get the market to recognize his plan, and I give him a lot of credit. So we would say we are not exactly the same type of business, but we certainly don't mind some parallels being drawn to what those guys are doing and this aspect, this business unit of our business.
Mark, I've been talking too much, so I have. Do you want to put Scott on the spot?
I can do it. Mark's been very quiet. You know why? Because Scott has got an absolutely superb studio setup, and I felt like I've been listening to a podcast rather than recording one.
I apologize, Jens, because I've probably been talking too much myself.
No, so. It's great. You're brilliant, Scott. I've really enjoyed this one. I've just literally sat back and listened to you. It's great. And I've been an investor in Regency Mines, as you know, and obviously it did have its sort of troublesome time, and it does leave a little bit of a sort of a negative taste in your mouth. It just by default it does, you know, but that doesn't of course mean that the company has completely changed like it has. A complete rebrand, and it looks like a completely different beast at the moment.
It really is. I mean, yeah. I say that. I know people always say, well, you're just saying that kind of thing. But if you look at it top to bottom, I mean, there are a few assets that have carried over, but even the way that those assets are being developed with this revised team is a bit different. I mean, look at the WoWo gap angle that we're pursuing. Look at exactly how Flexible Grid is being run. I mean, I think you can say, even with the overlap, it's a little bit different. And obviously, you know, from the board, I'm the only carryover, funny enough. And I certainly, you know, I don't shy away from taking the responsibility of a director to some of the history, of course. But I think anybody looking at it, you know, with outside eyes just says, well, you know, I was working for the founder of the business, you know, starting from a junior position. And then, you know, I decided to stay in the boat and really, you know, put my effort into taking it, you know, forward. So I hope people can see, you know, how those things play, and that doesn't mean that this is business as usual, I suppose, as you say, that this really is a new entity being run in a little bit of a different manner with a different team, a different group, some overlap in projects. Mm. And we hope, you know, with it, well, we know, I guess, with a group that's very motivated to succeed.
No, I mean, I'm certainly going to be taking another look at it again. I mean, it reminds me of another company that the first mining companies I bought, ECR Minerals, back in 2013. And again, I got stung on that one. But that wasn't anything to do, you know, it wasn't necessarily, you know, anything to do with the company. It was just bad timing. But it does leave a bad taste. But again, that company now is a different company. And I'm sort of back in that, feeling very bullish about that company. And I think, yeah, I'm really pleased we've had this podcast because Corcel, and look at your website. I mean, it's very nice. It's very clean. And
I hope people like it. I mean, we're always happy to take advice of people, you know, because it is a brand new one. And that's a big effort for anybody that's gone through that. Obviously, you know, the branding.
Absolutely.
You go from having to build a logo to having to redraft all your text. And
it's not
and
easy.
Make it functional, obviously, you know, I mean, it's a bit of that would have probably been done a little earlier this year, except again, that's where COVID again, sort of, you know, I think the idea of going and rebranding in the middle of the uncertainty earlier this year, we just sort of put it on hold a little bit, but we got that out right before, Hopefully everybody went away for August or whatever they did this year. Obviously, it's a little bit different than normal years, but we didn't want to put it out mid-August. So we tried to get it out early August so people could kind of chew on it. Then, you know, hopefully people take their little breaks, whatever they do. And now we're here in September and now we want to tell people about it. And that's in part why we wanted to do that. We want to shout from the steeple a little bit here and tell people the story and hopefully get people to kind of work through the various elements that we've covered here today.
Great.
I understand it a bit better.
Perfect. Well, that's great, Scott. It's been a pleasure listening to you. I can't say talking to you, but listening to you, it's been a pleasure. And as Kenny says, the 60-second challenge, were you briefed on that prior to the podcast?
No, I didn't. No. I forgot.
Okay.
No, I have not heard this one.
Well, we'll throw it on you then. It might be a challenge for you, considering this podcast is an hour and 9 minutes.
Yeah, considering I've been a bit wordy, I give it to you. I'll try. Go ahead.
But the 60-second challenge is when a director comes on, you get 60 seconds to sort of pitch the company to investors as to why Corcel is a good, potentially good investment, something to consider. So if you're up for that, I can count you in.
Go ahead. No, I can definitely do this. I've got at least three kind of key points I covered.
Okay. All right then. Great. Well, in 3, 2, 1, off you go.
Go. Okay. Well, the first point, I guess, and I think I said it the other day in a webinar I gave, was that we think we're on trend. We're on trend with the major transformations underway in the global economy. That's decarbonization and the move away from fossil fuels. What does that mean? That means the rise of batteries and flexible energy solutions in worldwide grids. And we're right in the middle of that. Secondly, I think we're a unique proposition. We've talked about it a little bit today. Battery metals, energy storage, and production. There's not really many competitors doing both those things. There's some mining companies doing battery metals. There's some energy companies doing the energy side, but not both. So we think we're unique. And lastly, I think we're an undervalued entity. I mean, just with what we have in there today, we talked about it a little bit in detail earlier with Mambare. We think we're ready to move. It's not about the next deal. It's about what's in there today. And frankly, we look forward to announcing progress on what's in there today in the very near term.
Well,
so I'd leave you with that.
There we go. That was good. That was under 60 seconds. Well done. Excellent. A good little summary of the last sort of hour. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Scott.
Thank you.
I'm actually going to finish with a confession. So I'm Scott. I swore I would never buy Red Rock or Regency shares again in my life. And about a month ago, I found myself buying Red Rock. And then last week,
yeah, it's had a good run, buying, as I said. Yeah. It's had a good run.
Yeah.
Held on to its gold assets, which are now paying off. So, hey.
Definitely. And then last week, I found myself buying Corcel as well.
Oh, so fantastic. Well, that's great to hear.
It's never seen never.
No, never seen never.
This game. From a Corcel point of view, just looking at the fundamentals, the market cap, the projects.
Yes.
At some point, the penny's going to drop.
That's right. The timing is right. I think it's a good position.
Yeah, definitely. But it's been great having you on.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Yeah. And we'll sure to get you back on again, hopefully, when you maybe have some positive news out of PNG, whether it's in this podcast or whether it's on Stockbox, which is one of our other platforms. We'll get you back on in some shape or form, but appreciate the time anyway. Mark, have you got anything to?
No, I think it's been fantastic, Scott. Thank you very much for coming on and talking to us.
Thank you. And like I said, hopefully I didn't drone on for too long, but I appreciated being here. So thank you.
Great.
Cheers, then.
Thanks very much, Scott. Cheers. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Tune in next time.